Hello, and welcome to Art Table's podcast series, Artist Perspectives. I'm Jessica Porter, Art Table's Executive Director, and I'm looking forward to sharing this series with you. Since 1980, Art Table is the leading professional organization devoted to supporting women in the visual arts. Art Table's Artist Perspectives podcast puts Art Table members in conversation with women artists at the forefront of their practice.
Eden Deering is the artist liaison at PPOW Gallery, a contemporary art gallery in New York City. Here, Eden talks with friend and artist Judith Linares, an artist who, in Judith's words, came of age in the socially turbulent Take It to the Streets days of feminism, underground comics, and poetic reverie in Northern California. You will hear Judith talk about her process, the Alleluia moment found in her vibrant color schemes, being a fourth-generation Californian, mythology, flowers, and more. Then you'll hear a reflection of Judith's early practice and what it means to be a young artist working in New York City today, as well as the ever-evolving relationship between gallerist, artist, and art market.
Hey, Judith.
Hi, Eden.
I came here today with like a million things I want to ask you and things we could talk about. And I was wondering if you'd be okay with first talking a little bit about the show we just did at the gallery. Is that okay
yes,
with you?
That's a great place to start.
Okay, great.
With the
perfect.
Almost present.
Yes. Yes. And for me, this being the first world of yours that I've been submerged in, everything was really pulsating with a really vibrant color. And I kind of wanted to ask you a little bit about the setting that a lot of, to me, the images seemed a lot of relationships to the sun. A lot of them seemed to relate in terms of what realm they kind of lived in. And obviously, I want to ask about how you view the female figures versus the animals versus that whole ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And I know it ties into fairy tales and mythologies and your own personal histories as well. So, and dreams, which we've also talked about. So like in approaching some of the visionariness of the works of this recent show and the color and just how you kind of got there for this show, because I actually don't really know.
Yes. I mean, people ask me about my color a lot, and I feel like it's very rational. Mm-hmm. In constructing the painting. First of all, the painting isn't preconceived. Mm-hmm. So I think about color first. I think a lot in pairs of opposite colors, if you were thinking about the color wheel. So, and I think about holidays in relationship to that, like red and green.
Right.
And violet and yellow and blue and orange are all colors that are opposite each other on the color wheel. So the very seeds of the beginning of the painting really have to do with color. So it's, I want to see an image that contains violet and yellow. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be the primary palette when I look at the painting. And of course, that changes as I go along. Mm-hmm. They really take a very long time to come together from that very, very basic kind of idea of beginning. And I'm thinking about forms and how they're illuminated in space. And so as the painting goes along, I'm thinking, is this figure lying in the forest? Are they, is this the moon that's, which might be a colder kind of light. So instead of yellow, I might go for a very light blue or a color that might suggest a colder kind of light. Mm-hmm. But often, most often, it's sunlight.
Right.
So I think, how would this form look like if the sun were over here in the mm-hmm. on the right side of the painting mm-hmm. or the left side of the painting? Where would the shadows fall? And what is the figure sitting on or laying on? Mm-hmm. Because there's the phenomenon of reflected light. So any form, and it's fun to think about, like your red scarf, mm-hmm. if you put that under your chin, mm-hmm. it will reflect in your skin. Like all of a sudden, the colors in the shadows around your face change colors. Uh-huh. They get much warmer. Right. So the light is coming from different directions. So this is sort of like shop talk.
Right, right.
Like people think of color as being so subjective. Right. And in my mind, I think it's so workmanlike.
But at that very first pairing, though, does that come from a feeling?
That I, in looking at paintings in history, I think about an artist like Van Gogh. Yeah. And he uses pairs of opposites a lot. Mm-hmm. If I were to use colors, if I were to conceive of a painting with colors that are next to each other on the color wheel, like blue and green, or violet and green, mm-hmm. or yellow and orange and pink, it has a less jarring, more harmonious right. effect.
Right, right.
And I'm looking for this wake up, guys.
Kind of.
And it is, I am looking for an idea about time, mm-hmm. actually, like sudden knowledge. Mm-hmm. Like this is a moment where right. I'm receiving the mysterious sudden knowledge, like right. the world is suddenly whole, mm. Kind of moment.
Mm. And that's sort of. In a joyous way, the wholeness and
it's sort
in a
of
good
I call
way.
It the hallelujah moment.
Right. Talk about the joy of your work and the happiness of the work, which is obviously there as we're discussing. But there's some thing under it too that's a little bit
yes,
as you think more a little dangerous too at the same time. And yes. sometimes I was thinking about too, and I was wondering if that's even though. It's a fantastical world. It's rooted in something it's reflecting still something real, I think, or something like that.
Yes. It's, I mean, and it's partly my choice of the subject of flowers. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful and it is a moment. Mm-hmm. And all things are transitory. Mm-hmm. That's the darker dimension. Right.
When did your interest in flowers start, and have they always been a part of your work? And I'd love to hear how that and other features connect to Disney.
I don't know. I think I've always had an interest in plant life. Mm-hmm. And I consider it kind of important to my biography that I'm a Californian and a fourth generation Californian mm-hmm. where one of the great pleasures of living there is the fantastically healthy plant life. Yeah. Like my grandfather lived in a little bungalow in East LA, and he had a poinsettia bush that was bigger than the house.
Wow.
That would bloom, you know, around Christmas time mm-hmm. with big red flowers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's always been, or it was part of the landscape.
Right.
A big part of the landscape.
Right. And that is obviously also precious. And, you know, it's such an unstable, California is to me also very, it's such a volatile.
Yes, it is. It's a living
thing
that produces flowers and has right. its moment and
right yeah. well like even
and
seeing
has its season yeah
right but even see I went, when the Hockney shows up at the Met I went it was happening during the same time all those fires were happening in California, and there was like that story about that couple that had to shelter themselves in their pool for like 7 hours with the so it's sort of weird fantasies of California versus that other side too. California. So it's like,
oh, right, the mudslides, forest fires.
Yeah, yes, earthquakes. Yeah. Because I know you're expert on fairy tales and how they connect to, you know, not just fantasy life, but real life, too.
Yes.
And I guess why painting them, you know, how it relates to painting.
I find it irresistible. Stories. And stories that people tell. And, like family mythologies. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a story. And the curative power of stories, i.e. psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. You tell the story, you listen to yourself tell the story, mm-hmm. and the story is some kind of metaphor often for the way you think about yourself or something you're trying to hide from yourself, mm-hmm. which is why I have recorded my dreams since the early 70s. And I feel like I'm trying very hard to be honest with the stories that I tell myself. Mm-hmm. But the dreams sometimes uncover truths that I'm trying to hide from myself at the same time. So that's really their value. It's not really fantastical at all. It's just another way of having an introspective conversation, really.
Right.
And I don't really use them to paint from. Mm-hmm. That isn't their purpose.
So there's not naked women and animals walking around in your dreams in the sun eating fried chicken.
No, but actually I worked with a Jungian therapist in the early 70s on trance work. And I would go to his office and he would, I would tell him my dream. Mm-hmm. And he would say, oh, well, let's look into this dream. And I wished I'd written this stuff down, but I didn't. But this is one story I remember was the dream was about being on an island. And he said, well, let's look at this island. And I went to the island, and the island had two women. One was dressed like a slut, basically, and the other one was wearing a gingham dress and she was a good girl, and they were trying to get off the island, and so they had to communicate with each other, and I guess it had to do with evolving a self-image.
Right.
But it presented itself in story form.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So is that a good way to look into, to get insight into some of the narrative elements and the figures in your paintings in terms of seeing them as metaphors?
Yes. And
not really about the nakedness or one particular, you know, but them as being Eve or being.
Yeah. I mean, there is, I mean, the bodies are primary. It's sort of evolved this way, but all of a sudden the bodies are really primary to the story. And it actually comes about in kind of reflecting on the process, strangely enough. I was growing up in L.A., and I saw a lot of good contemporary art when I was a teenager in L.A. So I'm seeing this work of the abstract expressionists.
We're mostly, and like most, Pollock, mostly male, the people you were looking at, or was it like, because I...
Big paintings with brushstrokes.
Yeah.
And there was Guston. There was
And Soar.
Pollock, I definitely remember. Barnett Newman. And I realized that part of my experience of seeing the painting was I was seeing it with my body. You know, the painting was telling me how close I could come, how far back I could come. And also, someone like Pollock is so it's so much about the evidence he left from mm-hmm. this dance that he mm-hmm. did.
Right.
So there was something in that the response that wasn't just from the head.
Right.
It was really seeing with the body.
Right.
In a way. So yeah. somehow that has come up, you know, what's come about is trying to get to that, but maybe in a much more literal kind of way where I'm presenting the body. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking also about the image of women and how they've been seen in art history.
Right.
And I was lucky enough to meet Linda Nochlin in the early mm-hmm. 70s, and I was mm-hmm. very interested in what she had to say about women and how they've been represented. Mm-hmm. And the idea that women were not represented the way men were represented in terms of their power,
right.
their vocation, their physical prowess. And I, what seemed most obvious to me was how women are very active
right.
and they have amazing power in their bodies.
Right, right. Right.
And it was part of my actual biography also. My mother worked out at Muscle Beach.
right. Right.
And it's part of the California culture
right.
also.
Right. Definitely.
And the picnicking. You must be out there. You must be athletic. You must
right.
yeah,
right.
be really active. So it was sort of a natural kind of fit, but sort of a, I don't know, a complicated way of
yeah,
arriving
right.
at the subject.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where you get into it being abstract and figurative at the same time, or
yes.
maybe a hybrid, or maybe just something new.
Yes.
But
yes, I wasn't trying to make something new. I sort of realized early on, the boys were never going to let me in their club, so right. I'm going to be part of a club. I always really liked the women that were telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about Frida Kahlo really early on,
mm-hmm.
like the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and partly because Mexican culture is
right.
very related to what happens in Southern California
right.
and very much at that, in that time
right.
frame. And I was very attracted to her interests and
mm-hmm.
and how it reflected her life,
mm-hmm.
her interest in her invention of herself.
Right.
And so at the same time that I, you know, admiring these great painters of
mm-hmm.
all time, I've also paid attention to especially the Mexican women surrealists.
Right. Do you have any, did you ever do self-portraits?
I did one. I mean, they're all kind of self-portraits.
Right, that's what I'm secretly
yeah.
just wanting to ask. But they're also, yeah, they live in such a...
This is always the problem, is like how to make the painting have a lot of satisfying detail, but not, when you get to the face, it's like if you spend too much self-conscious time on the face, it steals the painting.
Right.
The narrative of the frog prince
mm-hmm.
is you can't look at a frog and not think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that story.
Right. Right. And
yeah.
And you do pull from fairy tales as well, also to or
yes.
not so directly.
I don't want to nail down the content.
Right. Which it never is. Whenever you think you've got something, it's something. Something else eludes you in the picture.
Yes. I really prize ambiguity
mm-hmm.
and the viewer's involvement and what the viewer brings to the story.
Right.
And I wouldn't want to lose that by telling a known story, although right. I have painted Psyche and Amor, which is one of my favorite stories. And it is thought of in Jungian therapy like men's basic myth that talks about enlightenment is the search for the Holy Grail. Mm. And women's is the story of Psyche and Amor.
Which is?
It basically, Psyche falls in love with Amor, and they live in a cave. Mm-hmm. And they're his rules are that she can never see him in the light. Mm. And one day her sisters come around and say, what do you really know about this guy, Amor, anyway? And her curiosity gets the better of her. And she sneaks up on him while he's asleep. Mm-hmm. And she accidentally drops a drop of hot oil on him. Mm-hmm. And he flies back to his mother. And she has to follow him through the underworld. And the going through the underworld is enlightenment for her.
Wow.
And
you've just unlocked a lot of things for me.
So love and erotic pleasure is what draws women into finding themselves.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's why, I mean, so many of your figures seem so, even though they're complex and have a million things going on, I do think in terms, they do feel them as symbols of power as well, at least personally. I feel that from the work.
It's somewhat, Jennifer Riley said, they own their own real estate.
Right. Yes. Yes. As somebody who I work with a lot of young artists and I do my own pop-up shows and I'm just constantly around 20-something, young 30-something odd artists and painters, like, it's just been so interesting to watch how, you know, people are obviously really catching, the world is catching on to like the genius of your work now, and you've been an artist working since you were 14 basically.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure. And the way you've maintained, and you touched on it in terms of controlling your own narrative or controlling your own mythology or controlling the space that you create your work in, because I find that must be hard to do, to kind of shut out, like, the noise, which I think in such a highly Instagrammable art world where, you know, I find a lot of young artists giving themselves away a lot, like, having, you know, giving them pieces away, other art, you know, never having a body of work. And then never giving themselves that time to think. And there's so much anxiety and stress. Yes. And just, you know, looking at you, I feel like you have so much to get, you know, you're such a model of maintaining, you know, the work.
That's a really interesting point. And the only thing that I can point out is the world was so different for me. You have no idea different it was. I did not grow up with TV.
Right.
I lived out in the desert with my grandmother. I had lots of time.
Right. Right.
And there was no rush. I mean, it was the beginning of the effects of mass media and Madison Avenue and modern life as we know it.
And moving to New York in the 80s.
Yes. I mean, and the 80s were sort of the beginning of what? The really commercialization of the art world. Mm-hmm. I when I grew up and I was a student trying to find myself, or a young person trying to find myself, there was no market. The idea that you could actually sell your work was a total pipe dream. But I will say, I had a wish in the middle 60s. Oh, if anybody could ever guarantee me an income of $300 a month, I would be so happy. So that sort of gives you an idea.
Yeah.
Of,
right. Of the, right. Right.
And I was coming of age in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the great bohemian cities right. of all time.
Right, right.
And you could live in an apartment with windows in every room.
Right.
So there were good things. But, I mean, New York is the trading post.
Right.
There's no denying its commercial trajectory. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be part of something. If I had a college age child at this point, I would not have them come to New York and go mm-hmm. to art school.
Right.
Because it's, you know, the art world is so present.
Right.
Everywhere. I mean, what's good is also art.
I mean, present. How do you feel with us showing your work at fairs? You know, how... You know, and I'm about to, after we finish this recording, I'm about to ask you about one of your pieces that's coming up for auction that we're going to plan to bid on.
Oh, good.
So it's, but yeah, you know, sometimes it's like the fairs have just become so huge and constant. And I just was, you know, in terms of how you feel. As an artist being in the fairs and us asking you for work, and if you maybe you don't have feelings about it.
I want to be part of the story, and I right. know that this, you know, you get a lot of people seeing your work at the fairs.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Right. It's just the bottom line.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, painting is slow. I mean, I remember having that experience at the LA County Museum, like, my shoe broke or something. I had to sit on this bench for a while. And there was a Matisse. It's this great Matisse they have with Madame Matisse in the garden. And just being forced to sit there, mm-hmm. you know, the painting really took on much more presence in my mind.
Right.
I mean, something as simple as that.
Right. Right.
And so the fair is, you know, people just traveling through a space.
Yeah.
Yeah. Consuming images with your eyeball.
Yeah. Yeah. And but it does, you know, your work pops out so much. So in that way, to really understand it, it's gonna keep changing visually.
I like to think of a work. I mean, I want a clarity and a drama that can be perceived from a block away. I want. I've always wanted that.
Right.
But
right.
then I want to deliver an experience.
Yes.
You know, that you have the pleasure of looking.
Yeah, which...
When you get there. So it isn't just about consuming a quick image.
This series is supported by the Paula Krasner Foundation, established in 1985 for the sole purpose of providing financial assistance to individual visual artists. Each artist in this series has benefited from the generosity of the Paula Krasner Foundation through their grant program. The Artist Perspectives podcast series is just one way that Art Table works to support all women in the arts. To find out more about our initiatives for the advancement of women's leadership, please visit us at arttable.org.